Okay, there's my title. I want to take you back to 1977. Just random year, perhaps Queen's Silver Jubilee, wasn't it? I want to take you geographically down the West Country a little bit. And I want to send you into a newsagent to pick up, let me get it right, the Wiltshire and Gloucestershire Standard. Okay, and you take it home and you flick through it. I hope this works. And you see a headline.
Oh,
that's the headline. I'm going to have a bit of trouble. It's an unremarkable headline in a way. It's the kind of headline you'd see in virtually any local newspaper up and down the land. And it reads, Cirencester couple married 50 years. That's quite an achievement, but maybe unless you know the couple, you move on. However, if you lingered, I'm sorry, it's a photo of a photocopy. It's as good as I can get it. If you linger, though, you'd see the a photograph of the happy couple, Arthur and Mabel Trevor Wilson. Now, Arthur, or Trevor, as I'm going to call him from this point onwards, for reasons that will become clear, Trevor's been retired for some time and apparently enjoys stamp collecting and reading. Now, if you'd hung on in there for the story, at this point you might have thought, oh, well, maybe move on. But if you stayed with the story, you would be rewarded. Because hints of another Trevor Wilson begin to bleed through. Hints of a life before all that stamp collecting and trips to the local library. For one thing, it turns out that Trevor was awarded the highest military honour that France can bestow, the Légion d'honneur. He also picked up an OBE, an MBE as well, for his war service. So it's kind of getting a little bit interesting, I think. The story tells us in the paper as well, when war broke out, he was serving in the Territorial Army and later joined the Intelligence Corps and was one of the small party of men who formed a special task force to operate in Paris in 1944 at the time of the liberation. Actually, it turns out he's one of the first three British intelligence officers to not just enter at the liberation, but just before the liberation. And in September 1945, it turns out that Trevor Wilson here found himself in Saigon, in southern Vietnam, on another special mission. It's kind of a bit more interesting, perhaps, than you thought. And maybe this audience will like the next bit. Just dropped in halfway through the story is the following. One of Mr. Trevor Wilson's closest friends is the well-known author, audience participation, Graham Greene, whom he met during the war. Well, I think that is quite interesting. Let's move on 3 years to 1980. That was 1977, when Graham Greene published Ways of Escape, which I'm sure many of you will have.
Sorry, turn the lights off. I'm trying to do it subtly.
I was going to say, it's really rude to point, and all I could see was... Can I
kill the lights?
Yeah, kill the lights. I can cope with this. This is fine. This is fine. That's all right. Is that better? Okay. Okay. I'll just go back one. There. There. Okay. Trevor and Mabel. I give you Trevor and Mabel. And I give you Graham. Let's move on 3 years to 1980, the Ways of Escape, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. Greene has this to say about the genesis of one of his most important, some would say not his best, but perhaps one his most important novel in terms of its abiding cultural and political impact and significance. And I'm talking about The Quiet American, which was set in Vietnam in the early 50s in the final stages of the French war against the communist-led Viet Minh. This is what Greene has to say. He says, it was quite by chance that I fell in love with Indochina. Nothing was further from my thoughts on my first visit, which is January 1951. Nothing was further from my thoughts than that I would one day set a novel there. An old friend of the war years, Trevor Wilson, was then our consul in Hanoi. And so, having spent a month in Malaya, I stopped off in Vietnam on the way back to England to see my friend without any idea that all my winters would be spent there for the next several years to come. An old friend of the war years, Trevor Wilson. It may be pushing it a little bit to say, no Trevor Wilson, no Quiet American, Graham Greene might well have ended up in Indochina anyway. He did like to travel. I think we all know that. But then again, he might not. Now, in case you're unfamiliar with The Quiet American, and forgive me if you know it back to front, but here's a short plot summary, interspersed with a bit of history, just to contextualise it. The setting, as I've said, is Vietnam in the early 1950s, 1951 and 52, to be exact. The main characters are Thomas Fowler, a cynical, world-weary British reporter working out of Saigon, and Alden Pyle, a idealistic, committed American Cold Warrior attached to the US legation in Saigon, the quiet American of the novel's title. Now, in 1950, and here's the history bit, the United States government, the Truman administration, began supplying the French with military assistance for the war against the communist-led Viet Minh. This was the Cold War. But the Americans are nothing if not proud of their anti-colonial tradition, the world's great first anti-colonial successful revolutionary state, and they were queasy about the still expressly colonial nature of what the French were up to. They might be fighting communism, but the French were still rather dastardly colonialists. And so the Truman administration insisted that in order to get the military aid, they dangled it out, they had to take humanitarian aid as well, technical aid and economic aid. And that aid was to go straight to the Vietnamese or the Indochinese to improve their lot. And this way, the Americans salved their anti-colonial conscience. They gave the French the arms, but they gave the Vietnamese something else as well. Reluctantly, the French agreed. They needed the military aid, so they had to take the rest of it. And soon, Americans are pouring in, 1950 and 51. They're pouring into Vietnam. And not just military types to look after the military aid, but doctors, nurses, engineers, teachers, agricultural advisors, soil scientists, people who are going to do good work with the local population. And you know, the French really hated them. Really hated them. At root, I think the French recognised that these outsiders were doing sort of what the French ought to have been doing a bit more of for the local population anyway. But the French were also very hacked off by the fact that these civilians, we're not talking about the doctors, would be going around stirring up nationalist feeling, telling the local people, you don't need to put up with this, you know, this is terrible, you know. So they're stirring, it's, the French resent that. And additionally, I think those who run Indochina are very proud of it being French Indochina and see it maybe being Americanized before their very eyes, but they have to tolerate it to get the napalm, and napalm was supplied. It's not just a later American war weapon of horribleness. To get the napalm, to get the bombs, to get the guns, to get the aircraft, they have to take this other stuff as well. The French hate having to do that. Now, Pyle in the novel is one of these civilians. If you recall, he's a doctor. He's an eye doctor. He specialises in trachoma. He goes out with trachoma units into the countryside, treating the local people for this rather nasty, unpleasant eye disease. But covertly, Pyle is something else. We all know that, don't we? He is, in fact, a CIA agent who is secretly promoting a third force. And by third force, what Green meant was a military stroke political organisation that would stand dead centre, equidistant, there it is, in the centre, from the nasty colonialists, the French on one side, and the equally, if not worse, communists on the other side. It would be, you know, the middle way, a third force. Now, in real life, it is true that the Americans at the time saw a third force as probably the best long-term bet for Vietnam's future. But while the French continued to fight, and more to the point, die, the Americans couldn't go around promoting a third force in Vietnam openly. They had to do it covertly, identifying potential third force leaders. Now, in the novel, Pyle's true purpose is eventually discovered by Fowler, and that seals Pyle's fate. When a car bomb explodes in downtown Saigon, killing and maiming many innocent bystanders, Fowler detects the handiwork of Pyle's third force, embryonic third force, the shadowy General Tay and his myrmidons, and Fowler decides that something must be done about this do-gooding American before he does more harm. He might have, in his own mind, good intentions pile, but he's causing an awful lot of carnage and horror and destruction in his wake. Fowler decides to do something about him. Adding a delicious element of ambiguity to all this, of course, is the fact that the younger man, the American, has stolen away from Fowler, his Vietnamese mistress, Phong. And so what happens next? Is it a crime of passion, crime of love, or is it a political crime? Well, it's up to you. You make your own minds up. But Fowler leads Pyle into a trap, and Pyle is assassinated by the Viet Minh. He was a good chap in his way, a quiet American, Fowler tells Vigo, the French detective charged with investigating the murder. A very quiet American, says Vigo with grim Gallic irony. There we have then the outline. I've already made mention of the enduring cultural and political importance of this novel, to which I would add, as many people have, its prophetic quality. Now, it's published in this country in 1955, but by the 1960s, and a lot of people were beginning to see in Pyle the literary personification of US foreign policy, or more particularly, a policy bent on intervening in developing world countries, etc., and causing not necessarily good, but a lot of bad along the way. And as we move through the decades, yeah, Pyle came to personify a certain arrogance of power, a certain mindset amongst American leaders that really at root felt that most people, given a free choice, would really like to be like America and follow the American way. And so a lot of leaders in the United States, imbued with Pyleism, if you like, this Pyle outlook, ended up setting their country on what turned out to be quite a damaging and disastrous course, and damaging and disastrous for a number of the countries at the receiving end of this simplistic worldview. My job today isn't to bang on about that kind of thing. Maybe if I get a third invite to come back, or a third return, I was here 5 years ago, maybe I'll talk more about that. But before I get back to Trevor Wilson, I would like to share with you something that this man said to me when I interviewed him a few years ago. This is the Boston Globe's veteran reporter, David Greenway, this is David Greenway in the 60s, obviously, who did several tours of journalistic duty in Vietnam and went on to report on a number of America's subsequent wars as well. He granted me an interview a few years ago, and he said as follows. He said, "I have seen the ghost of Alden Pyle. I have seen him in the green zone on the banks of the Tigris in Baghdad, and I ran into him in the corridors of the American embassy in Kabul. The ghosts of Alden Pyle." Eerie. But back to Trevor Wilson. One way or another, it was Green's relationship with Trevor Wilson that drew Green to Vietnam in the first place in the beginning of 1951. Wilson was the lure that got into the country. And then the country itself, particularly Saigon initially, did the rest. This is also from Ways of Escape. The spell was first cast, I think, by the tall, elegant girls in white silk trousers, by the pewter evening light on flat paddy fields, where the water buffaloes trudged fetlock deep in a slow primeval gait, by the French perfumery in the Rue Catinat, the Chinese gambling houses in Cholon, and above all by that feeling of exhilaration which a measure of danger brings to the visitor with a return ticket. So what do we know about Trevor Wilson, our man in Hanoi, the man who brought Green to Vietnam in the first place, with such ultimately abiding consequences, literary, cultural, and political? Here's a CV of Trevor Wilson, such as I've been able to put it together. And as I proceed, if you pick up a frisson of Henry Pulling, before he met that extraordinary aunt of his and did all that travelling, I'm with you. It's hard to think of a more conventional middle-class background, dare I say it, slightly dull background, than Trevor Wilson's, up to the point that everything changed. not with an Aunt Augusta turning up, but with this thing turning up. Arthur Geoffrey Trevor - Wilson was born, but we'll call him Trevor Wilson as everybody did, in August 1903 in East Molesey in Surrey. He was educated at Woking and later in France. In 1921, aged 18, he left school and took an apprenticeship with Horace Hickling and Company, East India Merchants. But after 2 years, he packed it in and joined, this is the Henry Pulling moment, Barclays Bank, where he worked until 1938, so for the next, you know, several, 15, 16 odd years. His aptitude for languages, he spoke French fluently, absolutely fluently, and he picks up Vietnamese along the way later on, meant that Barclays made him a kind of roving observer, a kind of inspector of their southern France, French North African operations. That was Trevor. In between times, of course, he got married, as we know, 1927, to Mabel. Now, with war looming in the late 1930s, Trevor returns to England to become a junior partner in Augustus and George Fisher, East India Merchants, going back, it would seem, to where he began professionally. And that might be where Henry... Did I say Henry? That might be where Trevor stayed. That might be his lot until this thing turned up. War broke out, obviously, in September 1939. Trevor Wilson joined the Territorial Army and soon discovered that he possessed and... my daughter said, you have got to quote Liam Neeson at this point. When I was telling her about this talk, she said, you ought to quote Liam Neeson, that fine actor from a very well-known film franchise. Some of you may recognise it. It turns out that the war revealed that Trevor possessed a very particular set of skills. Turned out that Trevor was very good at espionage, that Trevor was very good at intelligence, that he was actually quite good at spying. Latent until 1939-40, but suddenly blossoms. Within a year, Trevor Wilson was working for the newly established Army Intelligence Corps before joining the Secret Intelligence Service, SIS, we'll call it MI6 if you prefer, in 1941, working in Section 5, Counterintelligence. Now, the writer and broadcaster Malcolm Muggeridge worked with Wilson in SIS Section 5 and remembered him as, quote, about the ablest intelligence officer I met in the war, with an instinctive flair for the work, including all the deceits and double crosses involved. A natural, you see. In November 1942, Trevor Wilson was sent off to that seething snake pit of political intrigue, French North Africa, to Algiers, and Malcolm Muggeridge followed him. In appearance and manner, Muggeridge tells us, Wilson was a short, unaccountable man with a toothbrush moustache, who spoke French like a native, albeit in a strange, muttering whisper, with his head bent down and usually a cigarette in his mouth, which got affixed to his upper or lower lip, wagging with his words, and in this manner he would carry on a running monologue, only partially comprehensible, and whether in English or French, barely discernible, in any case broken up by sudden, furious exclamations. Now, here's the thing. I would love to be able to show you lots and lots of photographs of Trevor Wilson. And though I have looked and looked and looked, I found only two. So if there's anybody out there with a secret stash of Trevor pics, do let me know. One of them you've already seen from 1977, 50th anniversary, wedding anniversary picture. The only other one I have found, and I have looked, is this one. It's from the second volume of Norman Sherry's biography of Greene. And it shows Trevor, I reckon about 1950 or 51, with the Catholic Bishop of Phat Diem in northern Vietnam. Trevor would be about 50 years of age in this picture. So if any of you have any Trevor pictures, do let me know. Back to the story. Wilson returned to England from Algiers in 1943. What he'd done in Algiers earned him the MBE and the Legion d'Honneur. Later the OBE would come in 48. And he then spent the better part of a year working at SIS Section 5's headquarters in Ryder Street in central London, nestled between Pall Mall and Piccadilly. Amongst other things, planning operations to do with D-Day. Or else, if he wasn't doing that, he was in the King's Arms pub behind St. James's in the company of a certain Kim Philby, who was also in Section 5, his boss effectively, and also a certain Graham Greene. To have been a fly on that beer mat, that would have been... More on that Greene connection shortly. Let me just finish with Trevor. Following the success of Operation Overlord in 1944, Trevor Wilson and Muggeridge were both sent to Paris on the eve of its liberation. Wilson was in his element, Muggeridge recalled, having acquired a long greatcoat which swept the ground, making him seem even smaller than he naturally was. He was the perfect companion for liberation. He would, I knew, combine his seemingly surrealist manner with a magical cunning in procuring food and shelter, and in finding his way to exactly the right places at the right time. He could be relied upon to make himself the master of any difficult situation. From liberated Paris in August 1944, Trevor Wilson will move on to liberated Saigon in September 1945. Let me say, that's my cue to say just a tiny bit about this Indochina thing. French colonial conquest of Vietnam, Laos and Cambodia climaxed in 1887 with the formation of the Union of Indochina. And French colonial rule remained uninterrupted pretty much all the way down to 1941-42 when the Japanese came knocking. And for much of the rest of the war, a collaborative arrangement obtains in Indochina, with the French continuing to administer their colonies as they always did, but the benefits of empire are going to this new upper tier of colonial management. The Japanese have become the colonial overlords. Well, all that ends in August 1945 with Japan's defeat. But if the French thought they could simply pick up their colonial primacy where they left it off, they were in for a very, very rude awakening. In the so-called August Revolution of 1945, the Viet Minh, a communist-led nationalist movement, led itself by Ho Chi Minh, veteran revolutionary and a communist, the August Revolution sweeps the Viet Minh to power. It climaxes. It's odd for an August Revolution to climax in September. But on the 2nd of September 1945, Ho Chi Minh stands before a crowd of 500,000 in Ba Dinh Square in Hanoi and declares Vietnam free, independent, the birth of a democratic republic of Vietnam. So that's the 2nd of September 1945. Vietnam is apparently now free. Exactly 2 weeks later, Forrest Gump-like Trevor Wilson turns up in Saigon in the south. What's he doing there? Well, the British are there because they've been tasked with taking the formal surrender of the Japanese forces who've laid down their arms, essentially. So you've got to take the surrender, you've got to disarm the Japanese, and you've got to send them on ships back to Japan. So that's why the British are in southern Vietnam in September 1945. In northern Vietnam, the Chinese nationalists are doing the same thing. Chiang Kai-shek's forces are doing the same thing. And soon, Trevor Wilson gets sent up to Hanoi from Saigon in the south to act as liaison between the Chinese occupation authority and the British in the south. Now, Trevor Wilson was in Hanoi in northern Vietnam for about 6 months, in the winter of 1945 and 1946. And as well as dealing with the Chinese, he met weekly with Ho Chi Minh, the Viet Minh leader, whose Declaration of Independence by late 45 was looking a bit threadbare. The French were increasingly back in the south, and they're going to be getting back into the north very soon too. Now, bonds of real warmth and friendship are established between Trevor Wilson and Ho Chi Minh. Trevor Wilson will remain a Ho Chi Minh admirer to his dying day, and if you want to get yourselves to the National Army Museum in Chelsea, a wonderful archive, you'll see some of Ho's letters to Trevor Wilson. Now, in July 1946, Trevor is demobbed, but he's immediately taken on as a private contract with the diplomatic service, and he's sent straight back to Hanoi to serve as consul. That's July 46. December 46, war breaks out between the French and the Viet Minh, and 4 years after that, January 1951, Graham Greene turns up, and who's still in Hanoi? Who is still our man in Hanoi? Trevor Wilson. So I come kind of full circle to that quote from Ways of Escape. So much for Trevor Wilson. What about Wilson and Greene? Well, as you're probably all aware, Greene himself joined the Secret Intelligence Service in 1941. He was assigned to SIS Section 5, Counterintelligence, the Muggeridge and Trevor Wilson mob. Not that he met Trevor Wilson at this point. After a rudimentary induction, Graham Greene is sent off, again, as I'm sure you all know, to Sierra Leone, in West Africa, to monitor what was going on in neighbouring Vichy French colonies. And his experiences there strongly inform, of course, the heart of the matter later on. Now, Green later insisted that his time in the Secret Intelligence Service was merely a patriotic spasm. It's the kind of thing you do when your nation's in peril, and so on and so forth. He just did what he had to do. And when he left in 1944, he maintained that he never had anything more to do with what he called the old firm. But I was talking to Peter Hennessy, who's now Lord Hennessy, a few weeks ago about all this. And Peter would do Peter much better than I'm going to do Peter if he was here. But he turned around and he said, no one ever leaves. No one ever leaves. And indeed, I'm not the only one who says this. Graham Greene never really, really left. More on that later. As for the Greene and Wilson relationship, it was in London when they're both in Ryder Street, 43, 44, that winter, frequenting the bars of St. James's, that their friendship is kindled. Now, there's Trevor's lovely handwriting, unlike Graham Greene's handwriting. The record of that friendship is very full, I find. Mike, I know, has been through the Trevor Wilson stuff in Boston. It's pretty full from 1951 onwards. It's less full, or at least I haven't found any more, and any great material before 1951. But I think it's safe to say that their friendship, even though Trevor's in Vietnam, it continues to grow, if remotely. And there is no question that when the two men meet again in January 1951, their delight and thrill of being in each other's company is very, 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 very real. Very real. Now, when I last had the privilege of talking at this festival, which was 5 years ago, I followed Green through his four trips to Vietnam between 51 and 54, making the argument, maybe if you were here, not very well, I don't know, that his real-life adventures were almost as exciting and extraordinary as the adventures you'd see in The Quiet American or in any of his entertainments. Now, I don't want to repeat all that, obviously, today. If you're interested, there's a thing called the Journal of Graham Greene's Studies poised to come out, and they are publishing a number of the talks given to this festival over the years, and mine's from 2012 is going to be in that if you're interested. Apparently, it's on the stocks. I want to focus in the time left to me on Greene and Wilson and what they got up to in 1951. Greene visits twice in 1951. January for 2 weeks, and he's desperate to get back, and then he arrives in October 1951 and he stays for just over 2 months. Goes into early 52. What can I say about Trevor and Graham Greene? This is a very apposite photograph. Well, what can I say? What larks! What larks they had. What a lot of alcohol was consumed. Graham Greene's journals, which you have to go off to Georgetown University to look at them, nonetheless, they will testify to the hangovers. I do not know, seriously, how they functioned. What a lot of pipes of opium were consumed. Wilson knew all the best fumoy, and Graham Greene was entranced, captivated by the drug, and he wrote publicly about this, obviously, as well. It's in The Quiet American as well, to some extent. So a lot of opium. A lot of brothels. Graham Greene's journal records this as in not vivid detail, but Trevor led from the front, I have to say, on this. Graham Greene begins to start referring to, quote, my lecherous friend, and on another occasion, my pimp. So there's a lot of brothels. But Graham Greene is not a reluctant tagger along. And Wilson also introduces Greene to a lot of people. He's an old Indochina hand. He's been there 4 or 5 years. And one of the people he introduces him to is a man called Warren Winkelstein. Warren who, you say? I'm going to tell you about Warren Winkelstein in a minute. But first, a few words on that great literary who was it, as opposed to who done it. Who was the real-life inspiration for The Quiet American? Now, for a lot of people for a long time, this man here, Edward G. Lansdale, advertising executive turned CIA man, was it. I don't think so. Frankly, Lansdale's recollections of meeting Greene are a bit batty, and I don't think the chronology overlays itself very well. I don't think they would. I'm not even sure they ever met. I think Norman Sherry was absolutely right when he said that the Quiet American Pile is a composite character made up of several Americans that Green met. But the guy on the right, as you look at it, it's very fuzzy. In terms of the things that come out of Pyle's mouth, in terms of his views on saving the East for democracy and his political outlook, this man here is Leo Hochstetter, who was a CIA operative when Green was in Vietnam for his first couple of trips. And Green ended up having to spend a very long car journey just with Leo Hochstetter, and he was a captive audience to Hochstetter's Cold War fundamentalism. And so I think Hochstetter is in there. But, you know, Warren Winkelstein deserves to be in there, and I'll reveal this to you now. I don't know if anybody's ever suggested this before. I'm going to suggest it now. The Wink, as he was known to his friends, or fondly to most people, he died in 2012 at the age of 90. But I had the honour of interviewing him about a year or so before he died. Now, Winkelstein was in Vietnam in 1951 and 1952, coinciding with Green. And yet, he was one of those do-gooding Americans that the French hated. He was an eye doctor. He specialised in trachoma. He went with trachoma units out into the villages, a little bit like somebody else I've mentioned earlier. So if you're looking for some kind of overlap, it really is there. You won't be able to see it there, really, but that's the Wink and a page from Green's journal. That page includes a reference to, with Dr. Winkelstein, Green writes, and a number of Vietnamese to Duc Ninh, a very destroyed village. Green's journal for 51-52 includes lots of references to out with Winkelstein, back to Winkelstein's for whiskey, back to Winkelstein's for whiskey and singing. What went on? I asked the Wink, and I give you the quote. He said, "Oh, he would come with me out into the countryside sometimes when I was doing inoculations and treatments. The Viet Minh let me go to places the French could never have got to because they knew I was trying to do good. And Green wanted to see what was going on, so he came along for the ride." In the 1980s, by the way, Winkelstein, an epidemiologist, emerged as one of, if not the greatest experts in the world on HIV and AIDS. I asked him, when I spoke to him, why he'd gone to Vietnam, and he said the following. He said, "I took 2 years out. My government asked people like me to go and try and mend a broken world. And that appealed to me. But the French hated us. And I didn't care much for them either." Well, the ones running the place. So I give you the Wink. Now, the French, including this man here, the imperious General Jean de Latte de Tassigny, who was commander-in-chief and French High Commissioner, the French hated something else by 1951. They hated Trevor Wilson. Trevor, you see, had been up to mischief. Trevor had been up to old firm mischief. And in due course, Graham Greene gets rather tangled up in this mischief. Now, let me explain a little bit. In 1951, when Green first turns up, the British government, or the Foreign Office at least, is on the lookout in Vietnam for the same thing that Pyle's looking for in the novel. The British are looking for a third force. Let me explain a little bit more. The British, you see, fear that the French might tire of this war that was costing them so much blood and treasure and throw the sponge in and just go home. And if that happened, the Viet Minh would triumph. And then Laos and Cambodia would go, dominoes and all the rest of it. And the next thing you know, you're going to have Chinese-inspired communism knocking at the door of Malaya. And Malaya, the emergency is ongoing, but Malaya still remains the jewel in Britain's Southeast Asian colonial crown and a vast dollar earner because of its rubber, especially, and so on and so forth. So, what the British are after is to identify a third force. If the French go, who could we look to rally the anti-communist Vietnamese and the non-communists? Who could we work with? And the British, by 1950-51, felt they'd found their third force in the Roman Catholics of Vietnam, about 2.6 million of them. And in particular, the man on the right here, he's also with his colleague, the Bishop of Bui Chu on the left, but this is a man called Bishop Lai Hu Tu, and you've seen him in one of the photographs with Trevor, who is the Bishop of Phat Diem, which features prominently in the Quiet American, in northern Vietnam. Now, the British could not openly cultivate a third force while the French are still there. But to do nothing, and then the French pack it in and go home, if you've done nothing, and then you start looking for a third force, it's too late. So it became a job, it would seem, for MI6. And who better than Trevor Wilson, our man in Hanoi, still on SIS books, to start the cultivating of what he, Trevor, in letters to Graham Greene, refers to as the Catholic solution. Unfortunately for Trevor Wilson, though, the French rumble him in the summer of 1951. Maybe he's losing his touch. He is reportedly drinking too much. General Delatte, who runs the whole show on the French side, denounces Trevor as a meddler to the British government. Trevor goes on holiday in July 1951. When he tries to return to Vietnam in August 1951, the door is bolted. General Delatte has declared him persona non grata. It is the end of a five-year consulship. Let's leave Trevor there for a moment and go back to... Oh, that's a second... I should have flicked on. That's another image of Bishop II. That's Alexander Korda. This will be revealed now. Now, Graham Greene, 2 weeks in Vietnam, January 1951. But the country, the people, the war, everything got into his bloodstream, and he is looking desperately to get back to Vietnam as soon as possible during the middle months of 1951. Graham Greene himself said later on that the idea for the Quiet American came to him during his second visit, late 51. I've picked up a little hint that it was earlier. This is Alexander Korda, movie mogul and SIS man. And Graham Greene is the guest of Korda on his yacht. They're bobbing around the Mediterranean in June 1951. They stop off somewhere in Greece, I can't recall where. There's an open-air classical music concert. Graham Greene listens to it and then writes the following to his mistress, Catherine Woolston. He said he especially enjoyed Mozart's Jupiter Symphony. Quote, because a faint idea for an Indochina novel stirred. Which means, ladies and gentlemen, I think as well as thanking Trevor Wilson for The Quiet American, we must also thank Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. But more seriously. Greene gets back to Vietnam in October 1951. In his pocket is a lucrative contract from the American magazine Life to report on the war. And this time Greene plans to stay not 2 weeks, but maybe 8-9 weeks. But this second visit is very different for him than the first, not just in terms of duration. For one thing, Trevor's not there. Remember, the door's been shut on Trevor. Except that the French give Wilson a 3-week temporary visa to return in November, going into December 51, to sort his affairs out. You know, you can't just kick a guy out who's been living in the country for 5 years. He's got a few business things to sort out. And there's a brief reunion between Greene and Trevor Wilson at the end of 51. For another thing, second time around, French surveillance of Greene is stifling. It is suffocating. He couldn't go anywhere without the Sûreté tailing him, unless it was out in the field with French forces, and this is at Phat Diem. But then the French are keeping an eye on him anyway. The reason, Greene later wrote, was Greene's association with Wilson and Wilson's association with Bishop II, the Catholics of Phat Diem, and so on and so forth, condemned Greene in the eyes of General Delatte, who saw Greene, who was, frankly, quite a famous Catholic by this stage, and known to have been on SIS books in the past. Delatte equates Greene with Wilson and assumes that Greene is just doing the meddling that Wilson can no longer do. Greene, of course, denies all that. Whatever the truth of the matter, and someday some lucky biographer of Greene or historian will gain access to the Aladdin's cave of his MI6 records. It's got to happen at some stage. Will it be me? I fear not. Whatever the truth of the matter, life becomes very difficult for Greene in late 51 in Vietnam. That's Korda again. Suffocating French surveillance makes it almost impossible for him to do his journalistic work, let alone get on with any espionage or sort of keeping an eye open on the Catholics, if you like. And Greene, you can see in his letters to Catherine Woolston, loads of letters to Catherine Woolston, and in his journals, he's getting nervous and he's getting edgy and he's getting very narky with Trevor. I wish to God Trevor would I wish to God Trevor wasn't following that plan of his, he wrote to Catherine. He's only causing trouble, not only to himself, but to me and all his friends. And such a lot of trouble too. Privately, General Delatt told an aide that he was certain Green was a spy. Why would anyone come to this war for $400? He asked, a reference to Green's alleged life fee. When Green heard the story, his sardonic response was that, you may have heard this, Delatt had dropped to zero by accident. $4,000 was well worth the effort. Actually, there were other good reasons for Green to go to that, war. One was misery in his relationship with Catherine Woolston, who would not leave her husband for him, and he, in a spurned lover, puts half a world between them, and in one despairing letter to her said he was going to go looking for a bullet. Another was Green's wanderlust, which we all know about, and another connected to that was his terribly low boredom threshold, in which drugs and alcohol and women, frankly, and the excitement of witnessing a war are all used or abused to keep those depressive demons, I think, at bay. But lastly, and by no means least, was another good reason to go to Vietnam first time up. There was Trevor Wilson and the prospect of a little light spying, a little gentle espionage. And that's the way it was. I think he did get a thrill from that until it got serious and he got spooked by it. But let me begin to close. If this will let me. Let me land it. 1954... The French were defeated at the climactic battle at Dien Bien Phu, and in July of 1954, the French War ends in the partition of Vietnam between a Viet Minh or a communist North and a non-communist South. By then, 1954, the British had failed to bring off the Catholic solution. But interestingly, the Americans make Catholicism the centrepiece of their post-partition policy for Vietnam. They begin to look to, not Bishop Tu, but to a lay Catholic, Ngo Dinh Diem here, being greeted by Eisenhower in 1957 in Washington. Ngo Dinh Diem here becomes the front man for what the Americans themselves call a nation-building project, where they seek to build a separate anti-communist South Vietnam. And not a lot of good it will do the Americans, and not a lot of good it will do the Vietnamese one way or the other. Meanwhile, Trevor Wilson applies for a new job. He hasn't got a job. 1952, he applies for a job with the Colonial Office as an information officer working under the Colonial Office in Singapore and Malaya. One of his two referees, you can see it in the National Army Museum, one of his two referees is Graham Greene. He gets the job, by the way. And his other referee is somebody called Maurice Oldfield, who, obviously some of you know who Maurice Oldfield is. He is, some people say, the model for George Smiley in John le Carré's world. But certainly he will go on to be head of MI6. So not bad referees in one way or another, I suppose, depending what you're going to get up to. Now, at the end of 1955, The Quiet American is published in this country. It's published in America early in 56. And obviously Graham Greene sends a copy. Of course he does. Signed copy to Trevor Wilson. It was as if I had been transported back to Saigon for a brief moment, so vivid were the descriptions of people and places well known to me, says Trevor, emoting. But Trevor liked this book almost as much. A few years later, Graham Greene sends Trevor Wilson Our Man in Havana. I hope it will amuse you, Greene wrote in the covering letter, though I fear it may not altogether amuse the old firm. Wilson devoured it in two sittings. It was so true and factual, he said. I believe it could have been entitled Our Man in Hanoi. In 1960, Trevor Wilson gets a new job in the British Embassy in Vientiane in Laos. It's returned to the diplomatic service, but not to Vietnam, though Laos is pretty close. And Graham Greene loved getting letters with a Vientiane postmark. As always, when I hear from you, I'm filled with nostalgia for Indochina, Greene wrote to Trevor Wilson in April 62. The following year, when Wilson's contract was extended, Greene is thrilled. It held out the prospect of a reunion, reliving old adventures, having new ones. And he was made up about that. But neither Greene nor Wilson would ever return to Indochina. Oh, that was my map of Laos, to show you Laos, but it's a bit late now. In 1969, I'm nearly there, Trevor Wilson retired. He went first to Worthing on the south coast and then to Gloucestershire. And you know, retirement, he absolutely hated it. "I have led a fairly active and varied life and have never known boredom," he wrote to Green in 1971. "It has now reached me on retirement. Country life does not suit me. No friends locally. No sex. No opium." No opium dens in Cirencester, it would seem. "How I wish I was back in Indochina. Perhaps one day." Later on, Wilson suffered a series of financial misfortunes, and he and Mabel had to sell their house and move into a caravan. Graham Greene and Hugh Greene do their best to help out, and the caravan is upgraded to a 28 by 12 foot mega caravan, luxury caravan, I'll get this right, complete with oil central heating, fitted bathroom, and all tastefully furnished. But it's still a caravan. In 1980, 3 years after his golden wedding anniversary, Wilson suffered a seriously debilitating stroke. Mike earlier said that he'd seen the letters. You saw the beautiful handwriting. His handwriting becomes painful and it looks like the writing of a five-year-old, and it's really kind of very, very poignant and moving. But he was still able to respond when Green sent him Ways of Escape in 1980. And he said that the chapter on Indochina brought back memories of happy days. Trevor, that's to say Arthur Geoffrey Trevor hyphen Wilson, died in 1984 at the age of 81. Now, I am really just about done. A couple of more slides. Graham Greene, I think I'm safe in saying in front of this audience, was a pretty remarkable and extraordinary writer. And Graham Greene's life is pretty well known, to the extent that the enigmatic Greene wanted it to be well known. And by the way, there is, apparently, I'm told, a new single-volume biography on the stocks coming out by Richard Greene from Toronto University. Oh, is he here? Oh, it's literally out. Okay, well, there we are. I'm behind the times. So, sorry?
Talking you extensively.
Oh, really? Are you Richard Greene? Well, it's a pleasure to meet you.
I've been an admirer for years.
Really? Okay. Well. Anyway, if I can cope with the lights, I can cope with the nicest heckle I've ever had. Watch out for Richard Greene's undoubtedly brilliant work. But the place of Greene's better known friends is also, you know, reasonably well known. I'm not so sure about Trevor Wilson. I hope you'll agree I've brought him, I think, into the light a little bit. And he wasn't just an enduring friend. I think he was a pretty remarkable individual in his own right. He was an unlikely looking super spy. Captain Mannering, or at least Arthur Lowe, has been suggested, or Mr. Pickwick, but his ability to win the trust and admiration of people he worked with was quite extraordinary. Now, leaving aside General Delatte, who I think was pretty mad by the end, the Wilson fan club included Ho Chi Minh, Chinese General Lu Han, President Harry S. Truman, General de Gaulle, the International Red Cross, Lord Mountbatten, a bevy of other French military men, General Giraud, Salan, Leclerc, and those responsible for dispensing OBEs, MBEs, Croix de Guerre, Légion d'Honneur. And oh, I didn't mention it, but on retirement from Laos, the King of Laos presented Trevor Wilson with the Order of a Million Elephants and the White Parasol. Now, I think the Order of a Million Elephants on its own is pretty good. But he got the White Parasol as well. Now, to the extent that Wilson drew Greene to Vietnam in the first place in 1951, our man in Hanoi helped give us the Quiet American. Wilson was the matchmaker. He brought Greene and Vietnam together. The chemistry was instant and the love affair enduring. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. We've got some time for questions from the brilliant Professor Richard Greene or anyone else. No, that's just my joke, Richard. Don't feel obliged. Any questions? Oh, there is one from...
Okay.
I won't heckle now. This is actually a really picky little question. I was wondering if you could help. When Green came for the first time, in one of your articles, you remarked on, lost the name of the man who was the head of MI6 in Singapore.
James Fulton.
And Oldfield was there at the same time. Do we know if Green met with them?
We don't know it. What I've done is I've gone through the journals, which I dare say you've seen as well, and I've tried to plot who was who. There's strange characters like a guy called Dermot Swan and others, and I've checked in with people like Richard Aldrich who know their onions on this sort of stuff. Onions, Graham Greene word. Or was it onion sandwiches? Different book. Catherine Wilson there. See, the brain's going now. You see the heckle's done me in. No, I don't know. Look, what do I know? I suspect it was extraordinarily casual and that occasionally Green would... I think Michael Sheldon has said this as well. Green would... Because he was quite parsimonious, I think, Graham Greene. That's what I pick up from the journals. That he would maybe ring up some contact or other in Whitehall and say, I'm thinking of going to Vietnam. You know, is there anything you want me to keep my eye open for? I say, funny you should say that. You know, the Catholics up in the north there. Would you mind? You know, maybe you know a few notes on them would be useful. And at that point, Graham Greene says, air travel's very expensive, you know, to Vietnam. And so. I think it worked that way. If he was meeting with the obvious bigwigs of the intelligence world, would he be writing that down? I don't know. So the short answer is I can't verify that. But maybe you and I can race to the MI6 archives. And did you try, by the way? I mean, I did. I got Peter Hennessy to talk to the head of MI6.
No one ever returns a message when I try to contact them. They're pretty impermeable. I'm glad you've had some luck.
Well, I wouldn't say it's luck, but just on that MI6 thing, I'm pretty sure I read in Sheldon and in is it W.J. West in the past that they were given a briefing by MI6 in which somebody looked at his file. And then were able to sit across the table from both of them and potentially answer questions. So, can you confirm that Graham Greene was in Vietnam? Blah, 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 blah. And they give yes or no answers. And all I wanted was kind of what they'd been given. I didn't expect to be given the file, but I wasn't even given that. So, there you go.
Thank you so much. Wonderful stuff.
Okay, thank you.
Time for another, if anyone has.
Thank you very much for your talk. Okay. Really informative and enjoyable. But I wonder, in Trevor Wilson's time that he spent with MI6 in London and with Green and Philby, did he ever, after that, express any doubts about Philby or any concerns, which, of course, later developed and were true and were, of course, true?
You mean did Trevor rather than Graham Greene? Because Graham Greene's relationship with Philby is fairly well chronicled. Again, the short answer is no. Although Trevor Wilson's papers, which were put up at auction and bought by the National Army Museum, have got lots of lovely things in them, they're not in any way, shape, or form a full archive. In addition to that, the correspondence between Green and Wilson, which exists in the Burns Library in Boston College, it's not going to give you that kind of answer. So, unfortunately, in dealing with this kind of stuff, there are gaps. We can make educated guesses, but there are gaps. I can't be more precise than that. But yeah, he would have. Wilson would have. Would have known. I mean, yeah, clearly did know Philby, but it would. As I said, I wouldn't mind it being a fly on the wall on the beer map.
And if I could just follow up,
If I could just follow up, did he ever express any admiration for Philby? Was he captivated by Philby as so many others?
No, no. If Trevor Wilson expressed admiration for anybody, he expressed it for Ho Chi Minh. And in fact, that's partly what also gets him into trouble with the French. If you believe, and they're rather salacious stories that Lucien Baudard, the French reporter, wrote in the 1960s about Trevor Wilson, he basically said that Trevor Wilson was a total drunk, that Trevor Wilson was, he called him a living wineskin. It's a John Bull boozer or something like this. And that Trevor wasn't just kicked out by the French in 1951 because he was messing with the Catholics and stirring up anti-French attitudes amongst the Catholics. Apparently, Trevor would do the cocktail party round, and after he'd had a few, he would turn round to the nearest Frenchman and say, "You're all finished here, you know. You're absolutely going to get wiped out. And a good job, too, because that Ho Chi Minh, and I know him, that Ho Chi Minh's a jolly good chap, and it's time, you know, you've done nothing for these people, nothing. The Americans have to come and show them how to have clean water, and Ho Chi Minh says you've built more jails than schools, and he's bloody right." and so, you know, there's a Clouseau-like character maybe going to take him running back to Delat. I mean, Graham Greene made fun of the surveillance, and he did talk about almost Clouseau clod-like characters, but he was really, really, really bogged off by it, really, and he felt as well resentful to Trevor, who he felt a lot of the surveillance was due to Trevor. But I think Graham was up to a few little tricks as well. But what do I know?
Okay, I'm going to draw a line at that. But there is time during the following.
Yeah, I'll be. You know, if you want to.
That's okay. Just as we do, we didn't have time for Tim Copy. Just to say on your behalf, thanks to Professor Kevin Wynn for such a stimulating talk. I know some of the story, I've seen some of the photographs and stuff, but it's told me lots and lots of things I didn't know before, in a highly entertaining, well, and informative way. Extremely good, it's been very interesting. And I can't wait for his book to be published in French.
Well, if there's anything left for me to say after I've read this next thing.
But yeah, do come back in 2020.
All right, okay. Okay, I'll do that, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.